Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otto. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Antoinette Daniel. Antoinette Daniel is an award-winning entrepreneur running three different businesses, a campaigner against modern slavery, a TEDx speaker, trustee, advisory board member, and a former PE teacher. Antoinette is passionate about seeing justice done in all areas of her life. On the back of a 12-year stint campaigning against modern slavery, she founded Just Helpers, her award-winning London cleaning agency, whose aim is to make the world a better place, one clean at a time. Antoinette's desire is to radically transform the cleaning industry to enable cleaning colleagues to be paid equitably, working rights and conditions to be more rigorously monitored, tax laws changed to enable ethical agencies to operate more ably, and clients' homes and offices cleaned to a consistently high standard. Antoinette says being a purpose-led business is not about sticking a hard-hitting slogan on a t-shirt, and it must extend beyond using recycled packaging, for example. This is so much more than making an easy gesture towards doing the right thing. To be truly purpose-led, the desire to make a positive impact should be embedded throughout all aspects of the business. Just as consumers are on the alert for cynical greenwashing, using purpose washing as a marketing strategy without the values behind it risks reputational damage. Welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Hi, Charlotte. Thank you so much for having me. That was a bit of a mouthy introduction, wasn't it?
Such a pleasure to have you with us today. So let's talk about running a purpose-led business like Just Helpers. What does it mean to run an ethical cleaning agency?
I think that's a really big question to ask me, and one 13 years later that I'm still exploring, still unpacking, still keeps me up awake at night. But I think with every business, running, being purpose-led is thinking about win-win-win situations. That's my big thing. So in the case of my business, a cleaning business, I think that we've got three stakeholder groups as part of that. We've got the cleaning team, we've got the client, and we've got the company itself. And it's about making decisions that enable all three to thrive within that while taking care of our planet around us. So I think that's as simple as I can distill it down to, if that makes sense.
And tell us about the award that your business won.
Where are we? Our most recent award, we won two in 1 year last year, and that was really quite overwhelming and surprising. So the one that probably made me cry was the DCBN award, so the Domestic Cleaning Business Network. And that really was an award from our peers, and I think that's why it was so meaningful. So we won the biggest award there, the Best Domestic Cleaning Agency in the UK, which feels weird given that I know so many great practitioners out there, but there you have it. And at the same time, we won a Trailblazer Award from the Living Wage organisation, the Living Wage Foundation. So that was definitely, both were overwhelming in different ways. But actually, I think my sweetest spot in that at the DCBN Awards, we'd also entered one of our colleagues for Best Cleaner of the Year UK, and she won. And that probably is the thing that had me crying on an aeroplane 24 hours later as I reflected on that and her journey towards that.
Oh, Antoinette, congrats on all those awards.
Thank you.
That's so rewarding, both to have the business recognize the purpose-led mission that is behind your business and the colleague winning best cleaner of the year. That's so wonderful. Now, you run two other businesses. What are they and how do they overlap with Just Helpers?
I have three unwieldy children, all businesses, none natural, and I don't think I could manage to have the two. So I call Just Helpers like my unruly teenager. It's established, you think you understand it, and then it hits puberty and all that entails. So we've been going with Just Helpers for 13 years, and I would say that that's my bread and butter business that pays the bills for me and the 60 other people involved in the business. I would call this my messy middle child, is a tech build. So I've got aspirations to build a SaaS platform for cleaning business owners, particularly domestic, because there just isn't great tech out there. So we've wireframed it up, we've had a failed attempt at that, and now we're out to fundraise something like £1 million to get it off the ground, to get an MVP, and to launch as we continue to iterate for the first 3 years. So that's my messy middle child. And I want to disrupt the industry because so much of the tech out there, one, isn't fit for purpose for domestic cleaning agencies. Two, what we do have to shoehorn ourselves into becomes quite costly quite quickly. And I think a pay-as-you-grow model would be what would really work for SMEs, which is 99% of the cleaning business or cleaning business industry. So there's that. And then my love child, which is on pause for now, which is called Entrepreneurs. And that was birthed between me and a best friend of mine coming out of COVID, realizing that running a business in isolation, particularly as a woman with all of the juggle that goes on, with all of the emotional pulls on you, was a lonely place. So, you know, common knowledge amongst women, we know that. But bringing between us something like 30 years of teaching between us as PE teachers, where structure and planning and being able to manage a wide range of fast moving things, including what I always call weapons, children with weapons within it, bringing all of that to bear and helping female business owners plan for success and plan their way out of overwhelm, which is where we found ourselves coming out of COVID. So that's on pause at the moment for various reasons, but that's the one that I think I naturally lean to because that's where most of my career has been, mentoring individuals and helping them to thrive and see the best in themselves.
Wow, Antoinette, when you talk about all the things that you're involved in, I'm just full of admiration for your energy, but also for your ideas. And it makes me think you started as a PE teacher and a head of department at several schools.
Yeah.
You then spent a long time campaigning against modern slavery. You've run Just Helpers for 13 years. You've got a tech company, nascent. You have other irons in the fire. How have you managed to reinvent yourself in this way?
I mean, when you put it like that, I don't know if I'd call it reinventing. I think I just mosey along, see a problem in my way and think, well, that needs solving. Could I solve it? Or do I know someone that could solve it? Often I'm like, I don't want to solve it. Can't somebody else solve it? And when the answer is no, I kind of put my big girl pants on and think, okay, how do you work this out? So, you know, one, semi-successful business, and two that are in progress. I wouldn't call myself thriving in any of them, but I'm just fixing the problems that are in front of me.
Yeah, I love that. Is there anything from your former life as a PE teacher, any skills that you now lean on today?
I would say, I think that it's to all the PE teachers out there, I think if you can be a successful PE teacher, you could probably run the world. I really do. You're used to solving problems at a high level all the time. It's unlike any other teaching environment where things can be quite static, quite controlled. In a PE environment, you're in one of the largest spaces in the school, often in outdoor spaces. You've got at least 30 children, if you're in the UK, running around with mini weapons in their hands. You've got to be able to command and control that situation and iterate in every moment. You've got to be able to read the room, read the field, whatever that is. You're working with the elements, which can turn on a dime in the UK. Often you've got one of the largest budgets in the school as well, because all of your equipment is pretty hefty, like a trampoline or a gym suite. So your budget, particularly when you're a head of department, you're budgeting all the way through and having to campaign for that. I learned my negotiation skills as a junior PE member of staff, because the kids that are in your care and usually in your department are often some of the gifted, most gifted in the school, and are interested in other things like music, drama, academics. And so you're always having to knock on a colleague's door and negotiate for their time and, again, find a win-win solution for everyone involved. And it often comes from our end rather than the other ends. What else would I say? Finally, you're kind of everything to the young people. So you're the minibus driver who is privy to all sorts of things that are going on in their life, because they just forget that you're there. You're the motivator, you're the disciplinarian, you're the educator. You help people see big things like, I want to play for England, and you break it down when they're in year seven and you get them there. So yeah, I think being a teacher, it sets you up for quite a lot of things.
It's beautiful the way you describe it. I can really see the bridge or the path from being a PE teacher to entrepreneurship. Now, in your recent TEDx talk, you explored what happens when we stop pretending to be self-reliant and start being brave enough to acknowledge that we are actually needy. And you said, because sometimes the most radical thing you can do is to knock on your neighbor's door and ask to borrow their ladder. Tell us about that.
That's hopefully coming out in a few weeks. And this is probably the most unexpected talk of my life. When I thought I fancy a TED talk or a TEDx talk, I thought it would be about running an ethical business and what that means. And I hired a speech coach about 2 years ago, a wonderful woman called Raina Steinberg. And we just explored and played. Like at some point, I got to the point where I said to her, I don't think TED is for me. This is just too emotional, the whole thing. Because what she was drawing out of me was the story of my life and the story of how I had been a very independent child. I'm an ex-care leaver. I'd learned very early on to rely on myself. I'd always had this narrative that I've got no backstop. If something goes wrong, there is nothing behind me. Therefore, I can't go wrong. So being excellent, being the top of my game has been my mantra really for as long as I can remember. But moving to where I live now, Worthing, 7 years ago, I wouldn't say some of that got dismantled. I think it was already being dismantled. There were already people in my life that were helping me see that I am not alone. I'm not an island. That's my big mantra. I'm not an island. I'm more of a peninsula. So I'm gloriously free on many sides, but anchored with a backstop of resources. But moving to Worthing and celebrating my 50th last year, as I stood on that rooftop, I looked around and realised, oh my goodness, there's an array of people from every era of my life. And something about Worthing had helped me drop my masks and learn to ask for help, learn to lean on people, learn to reveal my vulnerable sides, allow me or give me permission to say, I just don't know. Like in this space, in my business community in Worthing, I can rock up and say, I've lost the plot, or I don't understand, or I need help, or do you know someone that can give me insight into this? And I think in this last 2 years, as I've been exploring what would the talk of my life be, it's that it's interdependence makes us stronger, not independence. And it's from a place of interdependence that we can thrive and grow. And the ladder was a really beautiful metaphor. When I first moved in to my apartment, I had a blind that kept falling down on my head, and I just realised I've got three options. I need a ladder. I can buy one. I can ask my landlord to come and fix it. Not great, because he didn't want it up in the first place. Or I could borrow one from a neighbour. I borrowed one from my neighbour time and time and time again. And eventually he said, why don't I keep the ladder? I'll be the keeper of the ladder. And when he needs it, he can come and borrow it from me. And so it's just a really beautiful metaphor of what it means to live interdependently. There's a sharing of things. There's a leaning on each other. There's a vulnerability. There's an acceptance of help. And actually that there's strength in borrowing stuff and not being the giver all the time, which is one of the things that I also set myself up to be. I will be the provider. I will be the person that people lean on, but I don't get to lean on anyone else. And actually, again, it's like giving from an empty well. It's not sustainable.
Oh, that's such a beautiful story. And I felt so many emotions as you were telling it. And I feel like I'm going to cry a lot when I watch your TEDx speech when it's finally made public. But I think that growth as a human from that sense of it's me and me alone to I've built into dependence through relationships is so meaningful. And as speaking as a former South African, it speaks to me to the idea of Ubuntu, which is we are only human through other humans.
100%.
So it's such a beautiful concept. And I think that, you know, I really feel for the journey you've had as a young person who had to be so independent and really strive to be excellent all the time, because that being excellence was your backstop, to learn that you're still excellent, but that you can rely on other humans for a ladder or a word or advice here and there. It's a gorgeous story, Antoinette. So getting accepted as a TEDx speaker, you said, was on your vision board.
Yes.
I have to say, it's also on mine, just saying. And another of the dreams you have is to establish a grant-making and mentoring foundation for entrepreneurial young people exiting the care system. Mm. What might that look like? Let's dream.
Oh, now you're making me cry. So this isn't something that I voice out loud regularly to the depths of it, because it's so unformed. It's the thing that I feel I don't get to do until I've done whatever else I have to do. And I'm beginning to explore that. But one of the things that happens for care leavers in the UK, and potentially worldwide, is when they hit a certain age, so in the UK, 18, it's like they fall off a cliff. So having been totally supported until that time, but possibly struggling through all of the institutions, so struggling in education, struggling in family setups, suddenly, age 18, they're just kind of the doors open and they're pushed out. And there's limited resources for them. If some of them happen to be in education at that time, they might still have a semblance of support. If they're lucky in terms of postcode, there might be supported accommodation. There might even be actual accommodation available for them. But that's getting less and less as well with what's happening with our government. And of course, a lot of the charitable institutions that could support them are not getting funding. It's a really stressful time. For any of you listeners out there, if you have an 18-year-old, thinking about them leaving your home and just setting up completely by themselves, it's improbable, if not impossible. And so the stress load of that is already happening from the age of 16 and a half, 17, because all those conversations start to be put into place. You see quite a few mental health breakdown episodes from young people at that point. And I think that a lot of young people in care have shown great entrepreneurial skills already. So that level of resilience, that level of hustling and surviving, the way that they maybe have navigated their way through the education system, probably not ideal, but potentially masking a whole load of things that are going on for them and somehow surviving at the very least through education. But for me, I've always had an interest in what happens to care leavers or kids in care. I thought I would foster or adopt. It just hasn't happened. But over the last 8 years, I've started to think, what brings all these strands together? Well, one, there's an education flare in that. So one, at some point, I'd love to have early intervention to be spotting bright children that are in the care system, maybe from as young as 8, or as soon as they come in, and mentoring them all the way through, helping them understand that there is a backstop of resources behind them. They're not going to fall off a cliff. So putting mentors in place as they age through the system. Two, identifying those that maybe have got an entrepreneurial flair. And I think that idea comes from setting up a cleaning business. I mean, it was one of the easiest businesses to set up. I started it with £10 in my back pocket. It's probably one of the hardest businesses to run. I don't know if I'd do it again. But helping, giving some sort of small early seed funding for young people and coaching around what it might be to write their own destiny, really, to rely on themselves, which is what they've already been doing anyway, but with mentorship put around them. So it's a grant-making foundation that would give seed money to young people that have been identified as maybe a bit sparky, that's the phrase I'm using, very scientific, through the system, and enabling them to make something of themselves. Because we know that when we build businesses, we're building communities, essentially. We're creating employment opportunities. We're paying into the tax coffers. We're expanding our own horizons and expanding the horizons of the people around us, which includes family members and community members. So that's my fledgling thinking at the moment. But how you do that, I don't know. I don't know yet.
But it's beautiful to have a mission like that. And everything you're doing is steps towards that. And to have that as a kind of guiding principle or North Star is so wonderful. What did the Leaving Care University trajectory look like for you? How hard was that for you to manage?
And I have been so blessed through my entire journey in some ways, not in other ways. But I didn't leave my birth mother until I was 7. And she taught me to read, write, do mental arithmetics way ahead of time. So I entered the general education system and was labelled as a gifted and talented child. And I will always attribute that to her. So school was really challenging for me, but I had that label on my file, gifted and talented, which meant that when I went into the care system, bizarrely, one of the things that they wanted was to try and place me in a family with other gifted and talented people. So I was fostered. I was fostered into a single parent family, Caribbean family, but both my sisters had been smart enough to win bursary places at a private school. And wow. So bizarrely, I went to that private school. I've never heard of this before, and I haven't heard of it since. But it meant that I had a private education in a 2-form entry school with something like 20 children in each class. And again, it wasn't easy, but it was safe. So where I was flailing my way through the system, all the things that the average looked after child would be experiencing. So I was an impoverished child in a private situation. I had holes in my shoes. I had poor uniform at some point, poor hygiene at some point, stealing for food, to stealing cash to travel, all those things. But I was held somehow in this in this bubble. I made friendships for life. So my best friend at some point shared her ham sandwich for about 3 years, her ham sandwich packed lunch and half a Highland toffee. But I was supported, and I was supported by other women to be that would have broad aspirations as well. So in my narrative was always that I would go to university. That was a no-brainer. That's what happened in my school. That's what happened in my foster family. And so that's what I did. I went to university, having flunked my A-levels, but still managed to get a place. And at that time, my local borough, I had a great social worker that had stuck with me for about 5 years, the last 5 years. So she was really fighting hard for my Leaving Care experience to be different. They managed to put some support in while I was at uni. Some of that broke down, so I did start living independently from, I think, halfway through my first year. But again, the friends I made at uni, the house that we got, enabled me to stay there in the holidays. I worked 3 or 4 jobs, and I was okay. And when I left university, they'd got this new scheme where it was an old scheme, but they'd got a new build scheme where they were giving care leavers who were young women their own council flat. And so I was able to move into a brand new council flat, and that was my entire situation. But I was trained to be a teacher, so very quickly I got a job. I moved out of that flat eventually and was able to afford private rented accommodation. So my journey, so different to so many people, so blessed, like, you know, there's, I don't know why me, but it was me. And I recognize that. And all along, there have been people from my church that have mentored me, and I hadn't realized that. Older students, people like my first ever boss is still one of my life mentors. That was 30 years ago. So I've just been really blessed by the people that come alongside me and for some reason stay with me. And it's changed my outcome, I would say.
Oh, such a moving story, Antoinette. And I can see why and how mentoring means so much to you. Yeah. And how that's something that you wish to pass on. A slight shift now, you know, you run a business, you have employees. I'd love to talk about leadership and your leadership style.
Oh, I think relationships are at the heart of everything that I do. I like to understand who people are, what makes them tick, and what are their aspirations. So I'd say highly relational, values-based. I was actually just putting together this morning all of the personality profiling tests that we've done over the years of the team, past and present, and I saw a frightening similarity in terms of the people I recruit. But actually, people that share my values, that's probably one of my biggest things. And I think that came from Jim Collins' Good to Great a few years ago. Get the right people on the bus that have got a similar vision, and then the rest is gravy. We can teach the rest. And I think always within that, something about restoration. So a lot of my team are homegrown in terms of they started their life as a cleaning professional. But I or a colleague was able to identify leadership stuff in them and bring that through. I hope that I lead through trust and honesty. I hate being micromanaged. I like full autonomy when I'm at work. And so I give that to my team, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. So again, I muddle my way through that. But I want to create spaces where people can thrive, where people enjoy what they do, and where people can show up, bring their best, bring their ideas, and those are received.
I want to pick up on that idea of autonomy, because I too was micromanaged at one point in my career. And I, in order to cope with it, I started reporting to that person daily on my tasks, but it's at the same time, very quickly looking for another job. But the idea of autonomy as a leader, you want to give it, but sometimes it's not always received in the way that you'd like it to be received, right? So it's a kind of a tension that you have to manage as a business leader, isn't it?
It really is. And I had a really great business coach for 8 years, and he gave me this analogy of a football field. He used a lot of sporting terms for me because I could understand that. And he said, I'm letting people play lacrosse, which has no boundaries, or certainly when I coached, it was a boundaryless game unless you hit a physical boundary. He said, but what we needed was a football field where there was still a big area to play in, but there were clear lines. And rather than blowing the whistle on them when they'd cross the line, that you blow the whistle as they're approaching the line. But at the beginning of the match, you'd set the parameters at the centre circle. You'd set the parameters. Here's what's going on. Here's what I need from you. But there'll be warnings as you're approaching the line to help you stay in play and to help you enjoy your game. And that's been a really helpful analogy for me.
No, I was just going to leap on that and say, I think that telling people how you lead, first of all, you have to have the self-awareness and the self-knowledge and know how you lead. But if you can tell people how you lead, I'm going to give you a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. But if you're approaching a boundary, I'm going to let you know before you hit that boundary. It's so helpful, because then you're just making clarity for people. They know exactly where they stand. Which I think is fabulous.
You've put that so well. I think you're formalising the things that I wobble through and trial and error my way towards. But yes.
But I do think it makes people feel safer at work if they understand, okay, this is how my boss leads, and this is going to happen if I do A, B, or C, which is wonderful. Now, you know, Antoinette, from our previous conversations, that diversity, equity, and inclusion are very important to me. And that those have formed some of the key tenets of my book, We Need New Leaders. Mm. What do they mean for you?
I always find that a hard question. one, being a black woman in business and professionally, I know that I've lived in that tension of being underestimated and unseen. And so my natural way of leading would be to reverse that, to expect greatness in everybody and almost wait until, or not wait, but I'd always say to kids at school, you've got my full trust until you break it. It's on you. But as I'm giving you a blank canvas, full trust, go at it, like, give me your best. And I think that's the way I lead with humans, adult humans. It's the same. I think it would be wrong to say we don't see colour, we don't see disability, we don't see neurodiversity. I think that that's a really immature way of thinking and leading. People are different. But again, it goes back to the PE teacher. You know, you're in a classroom where you are dealing with 32 different humans whose bodies move in 32 different ways, and you've got to find a way of gelling that together, both for them as an individual and them as a team. And that's how I see people in the workplace.
I love the metaphor back to the PE teacher, and I was laughing because if I had been in your class, I would have been the sad little asthmatic at the back of the pack, and you were thinking, how can I get this asthmatic to move? Because she clearly doesn't want to.
And you would have, and you'd have loved it, I tell you.
I wish I'd had you as my PE teacher.
I always say if people hadn't enjoyed PE, then they didn't have a great teacher. Because it's about seeing what people are good at and helping them to thrive in that way. And I think sports is that. I think that there's a sport out there for everybody. And I think business is that. There's a role out there for everybody within the workplace. And it's a good leader's responsibility to find that and draw that out of them.
Yeah, that's lovely. So Antoinette, in the quote that I read out at the top of the podcast, you said that not acting according to your values as a business leader can be reputational. How do you think about your own reputation?
reputation takes a long time to build, right? So I would hope that my I'm known for being trustworthy, for being honest, for being fair and reliable, for sweating the things that matter, and for not taking seriously the things that don't matter. Integrity was always a big word for me, although that's quite a loaded word. And I think that's a very hard question to answer, because I have some idea of what people feel about me, but I think reputation is what happens when no one is looking. It's the stuff that only you and your maker can see. And I think that's my guiding principle. That's what I'm always trying to work towards. Okay, it doesn't matter what the world sees, but what do I know? What does God know? That's what I'm trying to build on. And as my harshest critic, I feel that I'm failing every day. So that's where I sit with that.
What I'm hearing is that it's about being true to yourself. So the same Antoinette behind closed doors as who turns up in front of her team at work. So as you know, my mission is about, we have this old archetype of leadership in our heads. You talked about 32 different humans in your PE class, but we have this old archetype, it's almost our neuroscience of what a leader is. We are managing to change it slowly in the workplace, but it still sits in the back of our heads. And I want to change that. What can we do collectively and individually to start to shift that sense of a leader is a certain type of man?
it's something in me that's boiling up. I'm saying the future is women, but that's a little bit controversial. But I think that there's a lot of feminine qualities that show up in leadership. I want to say leadership that lasts. So I think when we're looking at the people in our organisations, we need to lead with humanity. So we need to admit what we know and admit what we don't know. We need to listen deeply, and not just with our ears, but with our eyes and with all the senses that we've got. And then we need to act with consistency and integrity, whatever that looks like in the situation. I'm quite collaborative in my leadership. So I have an idea, and I have to often fight very hard not to bring that idea to the table, but to understand and I guess be humble enough to believe and know that yours may not be the best idea in the room, that actually nobody's may be the best in the room, but what you could collaboratively build could just be brilliant. So it's about creating spaces for real collaboration, where it's okay for people to disagree with you, where it's okay for people to fail, to make mistakes, and to learn from those mistakes and create those environments of trust, I guess, and safety for your team. And then one of the TEDx talks last week actually was around, I don't know if I can say this, so you may need to edit me out, but around enabling brilliant assholes in the world of work. So people that are charismatic and brilliant at what they do, but at the expense of the people around them. But actually calling that out, acknowledging the quiet people, particularly the introverts in the world of work. You often get shouted over by the extroverts in the room, of which I am one, but creating space for every voice to be heard. I'm a big extrovert, and I've had to learn not to land questions on my team in the middle of a team meeting, but to send those out ahead of time so that the reflectors can have time to sit with it, because when we get their answers, they're usually deep and strong and will enable us to push further and faster. Creating space for all of the different types to thrive. It just keeps boiling back down to that, to seeing your team as a whole and as individuals, and to lesson plan it as if you've got 32 individuals in front of you, making sure that each person has got what they need to show up and be their best version in your workplace.
Yeah, speaking as an introvert, I can strongly relate to how nice it would have been to have got the questions in advance so that the deep thinking could and the reflection could happen in advance. I think that's incredibly inclusive of how different people think and different people behave and show up at work. So now we get to the questions I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
Oh, I have been reading Unreasonable Hospitality by Will Guidara. And it's blowing my mind. So he was a restaurateur and was just looking at how he could marry the back end, that's the brilliance of the chefs, with a brilliant front of house service, and just looking at all of those tiny details that make an orgasmic experience for their clients, but also their team. And that's the thing that I'm really working on at the moment. How can I create an orgasmic experience for everyone in our triangle, for our clients, for our cleaners, and for the company? But his stories are inspirational. I would 100%, it's like page turning. I have to force myself to put it down at the moment.
One of my other guests has recommended that, and I now take it as a sign that I must order it immediately and read it. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So my intention also with my book and my podcast is to make life easier for the new leaders emerging. And we're thinking about people who come from diverse backgrounds, diverse identities, underrepresented minorities, who have a strong sense that they want to become leaders or perhaps in their first leadership role. What three tips would you give them?
One, find at least two mentors, one that looks like you and one that's possibly your polar opposite. You've got great things to learn. You'll need cheerleaders in your back pocket, that safe spaces where you can come and just say, wah, or here's my victory. So yeah, a strong mentor. Two, I'm a big fan of a vision board, of a dream board. Know who you are, get that out in some way, in some physical way, whether it's writing, pictures, whatever it is. And you use the word North Star earlier on. Identify within that what your North Star is, because there will be times in your life where people will ask you to cross your values line, and you've got to be really clear about what that looks like. And particularly when you're in a minority in an organisation, the temptation to compromise who you are because you know you're different can be very strong. So know what your no compromise line is, and maybe vision that out or state your intention to someone who's close in your circle. I think the third would genuinely be to know what discrimination looks like Again, when you're particularly in your 20s and 30s, where you're struggling to make your way in the world, it can be quite easy to just put a blinker on to all of the things that are hampering your progress or the people that are hampering your progress. So one of the things that I love about Gen Z, they're just not taking any nonsense around this kind of stuff. But again, unless you know what your rights are, or you can't hold people to task in that. I think those would be my three.
Oh, those are beautiful tips, and I especially love know where, when your values are being crossed, and know how you're going to push back and almost say that aloud, and then also know what discrimination looks like, because if you don't know it, you can't identify it, and then you can't say anything. But if you know it, that's the first step towards empowerment, isn't it? So
absolutely.
Such a wonderful answer. Thank you. So Antoinette, we're coming to the end. My very last question. In this world that is sometimes difficult, sometimes feels heavy, what brings you joy?
Oh, what brings me joy is gathering people around a table with food and going deep. I think community brings me joy, and real authenticity and vulnerability within that. But community around food, like, ultimate joy.
Oh, what a lovely answer. Antoinette Daniel, thank you for joining me on Speech Bubble. If you enjoyed this episode, please do follow Speech Bubbles to get new episodes as they land on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please tell all your friends. And if you're interested in the ideas in this podcast around reputation, leadership, and diversity, you'll probably enjoy my book, We Need New Leaders, which is available online and in all good bookstores. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.